welcome to this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. I'm your host, Webster Topley, here in Washington, D.C., and we have a full plate of catastrophic economic developments this week. Let's go to the heart of the matter right at the beginning. This past March 30th was a catastrophic day for the United States. This was the day that Obama, to some degree, dropped his mask, exposed himself more as a puppet of Wall Street intent on destroying the industrial economy of the United States than he had up to now. It is clear, based on Obama's refusal to grant any short-term funds to General Motors and Chrysler, that he is committed to driving the U.S. auto industry into bankruptcy. This is an asset-stripping operation at the highest level. This is going to be the greatest fire sale, distressed merchandise sale in recent history. The vultures, the bottom feeders, the asset strippers are looking around. Soros, the Blackstone Group, J.C. Flowers, that guy Wilbur, whatever his name is, are all eyeing the industrial plant and equipment of the American Middle West, and they're thinking about how they can strip it and sell it off. The other side of it, of course, is it's not just the factories that will be destroyed. The United Auto Workers is now on track to get busted by Obama. More than a year ago, I warned on this program, Obama is the strike breaker, the union buster. Obama, his family business is to bust unions. That is what American foundations do, the Ford, the Annenberg, the Gates, the Broad, and so forth. And along with his commitment to destroy the teachers' union and public sector unionism, Obama is committed to bust the United Auto Workers, the most militant traditionally of the CIO, Congress of Industrial Organizations, trade unions coming out of the 1930s and eventually merging with the AFL-CIO. But if the UAW can be destroyed, then all the others can be destroyed, be they the steel workers, the electrical workers, and so on down the line. That is the goal of this operation. Drive General Motors and Chrysler into bankruptcy as soon as possible, asset strip them, and bust the United Auto Workers. Because, of course, when you go into bankruptcy, then the labor contract gets thrown out the window, and you'll have a reactionary to fascist judge sitting there as the bankruptcy administrator, some Bush appointee, no doubt, who will lick his chops and say, now is the chance to destroy trade unionism here in the United States. Notice, of course, though, when AIG is in trouble, those contracts are sacrosanct. The contracts under which AIG gave all those hundreds of millions of dollars of bonuses, and, of course, Bank of America gave billions, and Citigroup gave billions, and Merrill Lynch gave billions of TARP money, taxpayer money, to their parasitical, incompetent, bungling, greedy corporate officials. Of course, that's sacrosanct. But then when it comes to the labor contract at General Motors or Chrysler with the UAW, and indeed the UAW of the auto workers of Canada now, that is expendable. So this is the duplicity. Now, we've talked here about what should happen to auto. These plants have got to be nationalized. You have got to preserve at all costs those assembly lines, those workers, that accumulated buildup of experience and productive capability, above all the machine tool capability. The tool and die capability that is built into the auto industry is an absolutely indispensable national asset, and it means that the machine tool capability that depends on Detroit is absolute key to national survival. It is, of course, also a resource for humanity as a whole. The one thing you can say about the Detroit factories is reconvert those factories. They can lift the world. So nationalize them. Act under the Defense Production Act and other relevant legislation to say, since we have this wonderful national emergency bequeathed to us by Bush the Younger, seize General Motors, seize Chrysler. In the case of Chrysler, get Cerberus Hedge Fund out of the picture. Those are raptors Those are the people who have driven Chrysler into the ground. Chrysler is a perfectly viable firm, in many ways showing a flair for creativity in some of their designs. They can be reconverted. General Motors, same thing. And, of course, here the amount of productive capability is even larger. What you want to do, of course, is to remove people like Nardelli, who have been put in there by Chrysler, who don't come from the auto industry, have no idea of what they're doing, or essentially dancing to the tune of Wall Street. Now, in the case of Wagoner, the obvious thing with Wagoner is that here was somebody who, whatever else he was undoubtedly devoted to General Motors. Maybe there was a danger that he would fight to save General Motors from being broken up and fed into the jaws of these sharks. In other words, stop General Motors from being asset-stripped, broken up, and destroyed. He might even have had an idea that productive labor is essential, although that's very rare. So Obama, acting with unbelievable arrogance and indeed illegal, acting in the logic of the fascist corporate state, because that's what this is now, Obama drives out Wagoner because, I believe, Wagoner was somebody who might have put up some resistance. He might have fought back. He might have said, Barkey, no, you're not going to destroy 120 years of productive capability that we've been able to put together here on the banks of the Great Lakes. Well, Wagoner is now gone. Notice the double standard. Notice the hypocrisy. Here's where you really see Obama's mission. AIG is in trouble. They need $40 billion. They get it right away. No questions asked. J.P. Morgan Chase, they're in trouble. They need money under the TARP, under the original $700 billion rescue. They get $20 billion for themselves and $20 billion for the fact that they're absorbing Bear Stearns. Same story with Citibank. They've been refinanced three times. They're into the U.S. government for $40 billion U.S. dollars. Bank of America, similar, $20 to $25 billion. Wells Fargo, Wachovia, $20 billion. They don't have to show viability. They don't have to show that they can reconvert. They don't have to show anything. They snap their fingers. The money is delivered at the midnight on Saturday night so that the publicity will be as little as possible. Notice now how these industrial managers, whoever they are, right, the Nardellis, the Wagoners, and so forth, they are made to jump through hoops. They have to wear sackcloth and ashes and so forth. This is obviously symbolism, but it's a symbolism that says in Obama's world, as I have argued here repeatedly for more than a year, in Obama's world there's only one interest that counts, Wall Street, Wall Street, Wall Street. Derivatives, 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 hedge funds, hedge funds, hedge funds, the raptors, lampreys, ticks, and you know the drill. At the same time, industrial employment, industrial production is viewed as something undesirable. It's important to get rid of it. Obama has this vision of the gangrene economy dancing in front of his eyes. Of course, it's put there by Holdridge, the de-development fiend, the austerity ghoul and gangrene economy expert who sits in the White House as a science advisor. The science advisor in the White House for Obama is someone who hates science and is determined to destroy science and discredit it. So that's what's going on at that level. So the goal here is to exalt the interest of Wall Street. And we know the arithmetic is that under Obama, given the fact that he was an endorser and supporter and organizer of the first bailout, the TARP back in October, it's $10 trillion to $11 trillion for the banks, and if we're lucky, one-third of a trillion for any productive use or popular development for the American people. We'll be back in a minute.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. As usual, we want to call your attention to meritorious ventures that are currently going on. One is my own book, Surviving the Cataclysm, Your Guide to the Worst Financial Crisis in Human History, second edition of the original, published in 1999, which I think in a matter nothing short of prophetic, identified the principal tendencies of the world economy leading towards breakdown, crisis, and disintegration, and the definition of disintegration, and why disintegration is worse than mere collapse on the 1929 or 1987 model. All of that is included, historically grounded, in the book. I pointed to deindustrialization, the great U-turn, the decline of the U.S. standard of living, then by about one-half, now by approximately two-thirds, or approaching two-thirds, the immiseration of America, deindustrialization, declining standards of living, and then on the other side, the casino economy, the bubble economy, the globalized hot money economy instituted during the 1990s, and at the center of that, derivatives. The derivatives cancer, or as President Chirac of France said, derivatives are financial AIDS. They now dominate the world. They were the centerpiece of this idiotic conference, which just took place in London, which we will discuss in the second hour. So go to www.progressivepress.com, www.progressivepress.com, all lowercase, all one word, and you can order the pre-publication copy. Publication is now imminent, but still you'll get the electronic version first, and you'll get the paper version later on if you buy it now. I also call your attention to Alex Jones and his excellent documentary, I think a classic, a masterpiece, The Obama Deception. You can get that at Infowars.com, PrisonPlanet.com. Otherwise, my Obama books remain indispensable. Obama, the Postmodern Coup, The Making of a Manchurian Candidate. Get that at Amazon.com. And Barack H. Obama, The Unauthorized Biography. Big development in that book about the foundations, the Ford Foundation, and their union-busting strategy. And this is what you're seeing now. Obama is a union-buster by trade. That is what it means to be an Alinskyite community organizer, or poverty pimp is the actual term. It is to be a strikebreaker, a scab. There's no way around it. Someone who is out there attempting to play desperate unemployed people, poverty-stricken unemployed, against trade unionists. That's the classic strategy for breaking strikes. And, of course, with the unemployed being there, you can do that under left cover. If you send the police, you get a backlash. But if you use left cover, the way Obama knows how to do it, then you can bust the strike and look like a benefactor of the poor and the excluded. So that's also available. Barack H. Obama, The Unauthorized Biography at Amazon.com. The 30th of March is a defeat for the United States on the scale of Pearl Harbor, the cannonade of Fort Sumter. It's hard to find parallels. It is a colossal defeat, a very dark day for this country. With Obama's policies, the absolute dominion of Wall Street, and it's total. All those left liberals, the Chomskyites and so forth, who have been babbling for years about a military-industrial complex, now have to confront the fact there is none. There is no military-industrial complex. Chrysler was famous for making tanks. What's going to happen to them? General Motors, right? Jeeps came off those assembly lines. These are the assembly lines that were reconverted in World War II to make B-17s, B-29s, you name it. These are the factories that equipped the Red Army that fought World War II. These are the factories that defeated fascism. Without those factories, Hitler and Tojo would have had a much easier time of it, put it that way. So these are the factories that Obama now proposes to destroy. The pompous arrogance, the stupidity of this little man are unbelievable. He is a pretentious fop, a fool, a cretin, a pompous cretin, who knows nothing of economics. He doesn't even know that it's price earnings ratio, not profit earning ratio, Barkey. Got to go back to the your school moms on that one. That that woman there in the White House, the head of the Council of Economic Advisors, has got to give you another lesson on that stuff before you start pontificating. And, of course, it all comes off the omnipresent teleprompter. The teleprompter seems to be controlled by Geithner. In reality, by Summers, and behind Summers, of course, Paul Adolph Volcker of the New York Federal Reserve, the Treasury, and then the Federal Reserve System. So this is the regime of finance capital in the pure state. There is no industrial interest. Defense industries get very little as far as I can see so far. Maybe they'll catch up a little bit. But the main idea is things that the leftist believes run the world, like big oil or defense, count for very little. What counts for something is Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, and, of course, given the presence of Bob Rubin, who is the centerpiece of this Geithner, Summers, Shapiro, Gensler clique, these characters run the administration, and they dictate. Remember Charlie Wilson? What's good for General Motors is good for America? No, no, no. Rubin, Summers, and Geithner say, what's good for Wall Street is good for America. Also, notice the contradiction of these measures. We were told with the first $700 billion, the original TARP, we're told that this is a bailout of Main Street, not of Wall Street. The reason for giving this money is so the Wall Street banks will get the credit system going again, and they will lend. All right. General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler need credit. They need loans. They would need a lot of loans. They would need to reconvert their plant and equipment to modernize it and begin producing different things, given the fact that the demand for individual motor vehicles will not be sufficient to maintain them. But there's a lot that needs to be done, so don't worry about that. The big issue now is, where were J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Citibank, Wells Fargo, and the rest of them? Did they step up and provide credit for General Motors and Chrysler? No. That's why these companies are going to the government in the first place, because the commercial banking system is composed of zombie banks run by zombie bankers, and they don't give credit. They haven't done it. And again, plenty of examples. Circuit City, 600, 700 stores, 35,000 jobs. They needed some financing to be able to go into a controlled Chapter 11 and then come out of it. Where were J.P. Morgan Chase, Citibank, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley? Where were they? Did they step up to the plate? Did they show their gratitude for all the tens of billions they'd gotten from the taxpayers? No. So the whole thing is bunk. The destruction of General Motors is what the entire bailout program was supposed to avoid. It was not supposed to be to maintain the banks as zombie entities in their own right for the sake of having zombie entities on the scene. It was supposed to be to save the real underlying economy. And you see, it doesn't work. So the entire TARP is a failure. The entire bailout is a cruel hoax and a bogus sham. And we'll be back in a minute.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN, great talk radio starts here.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. This is your host, Webster Tropley, here in Washington, D.C. So the United States is now well on its way to the status of a shattered hulk, a ravaged derelict floating aimlessly on the troubled waters of the world economic crisis, adrift on the ocean of adventures, be they political or economic. Obama's measures clearly aim at the bankruptcy of the big three automakers, their breakup, their destruction, a feast for the hyenas of the asset-stripping, bottom-fishing organizations, Blackstone, J.C. Flowers, people like this, coming in and buying certain choice chunks. Massive increase of unemployment. Notice all this done under left cover, all of it done gradually on the installment plan. The situation of the poor, the leadership of the United Auto Workers couldn't be more pathetic. They would have to essentially call for a general strike. They would have to call for a general strike against Obama and demand that the United States maintain a full-set economy. The question of a full-set economy goes like this. If you don't have a machine tool industry, which depends, of course, on the existence of Detroit, in other words, the way in which many machine tool industry operations, the few that remain, the way that they stay above water is because they fulfill orders for the Detroit and related auto industry. You've got to have a machine tool industry. You've got to have these auto plants. You've got to have the entire system of subcontractors around them, right? The American Axle, Delphi, all the rest of the components that go into an automobile. If these collapse, if these are assets stripped and broken up and destroyed, you don't have a full-set economy anymore. Now, I appeal to all, note well, if you don't have a full-set economy in today's world, you are ethnographic material. Maybe Chinese anthropologists will come to study the backwardness and misery of the population of North America, who will have fallen into chaos and destruction, into some kind of a dead-end primitive society, a neo-primitive society. This is human civilization at stake. If you don't have a full-set economy, that is the destiny which awaits you. It means that you're like that Tennessee Williams character who had to depend on random acts of kindness on the part of strangers. The only way you can have a nation, the only way you can have some modicum of national security, because there is a world out there not completely benign, is to have an adequate industrial base, hopefully a growing industrial base. What Obama is proposing to do is to destroy what remains of that base. This is an incredibly ominous thing. Naturally, in this, Obama continues the activities of one of his prime White House advisors, Paul Adolf Volcker. You'll remember that Paul Adolf Volcker at the Fed from 1979 to 1987 with his unbelievable 22% prime rate. Lending rate, 22% for prime rate customers, for the big boys. But for the rest of us, that became 25, 30, 35%. The high interest rates you're paying on a credit card today are courtesy of Paul Adolf Volcker, who instituted usury as U.S. government policy, destroyed the various usury laws in the various states. This is all written up in some detail in Surviving the Cataclysm, which you can get from www.progressivepress.com. It is the great U-turn which came under Carter and Volcker, the turn away from a high-wage economy to a low-wage economy, a deindustrialized moonscape. The United States is now a junkyard. It is a rubble field, a post-industrial moonscape as a result of the depredations of the financiers over these decades. Now, a few islands of industry have held out in that Great Lakes area. They are now slated to be destroyed by Obama. Now, we're told, don't worry, the auto industry is only 2 or 3% of gross domestic product. Now, we're going to try to critique these crazy ideas of gross domestic product in one of the segments today or maybe next time. This is highly misleading because, of course, the gross domestic product of the United States, the way it's stated by government agencies, contains all manner of paper speculation, parasitical financial operations, and so forth. Remember, any human society survives on the basis of a surplus created by industrial and agricultural production. And in that, the agricultural and industrial production, industrial above all, the Detroit complex with all of its subcontractors represents a much, much larger percentage than this 2 to 3%. It may be 10%, 15%, 20% or more. Hard to estimate. It might be a quarter. It might be a third, somewhere in there. And it represents the critical margin of keeping this entire thing going, because if you let Detroit go down, that series of chain reaction plant closures as critical component parts begin to disappear from the market, even if only one goes down. If Chrysler goes down by itself, it means that the entire subcontracting sector around Detroit will be bankrupted and put out of business. So this is huge. It is the question of thermodynamic collapse, so-called heat death. Thermodynamic collapse simply means you have to imagine a situation where everything begins to break down. You try to go to your job in the morning, the subway breaks down, the subway derails, the cars go off the tracks. There's an attempt to bring in some equipment that to remedy that. That breaks down. There's an attempt to order it from outside the city, and the railway system breaks down. There's an attempt to fly it in, and for some reason that doesn't work. The plane crashes. In other words, a chain reaction, which is possible in the middle of an economy which has been so exhausted and so decimated by decades of financier rule that it is literally on the brink of physical collapse, not even financial collapse, bad as that can be, but physical breakdown, physical collapse. That is the question of the thermodynamic breakdown or thermodynamic collapse of the U.S. economy. In other words, your ability to stay alive, to maintain civilization. Another way to put it, right now we have in the U.S., 320 million people. That implies a certain level of production that's necessary to keep that going. Now, don't say, oh, we'll just use dollars to buy what we need, because those dollars, we've had a signal now from the London Group of 20 that the special drawing rights is in the process of replacing the dollar. Funny, not Iraq, not North Korea, but the IMF, the International Monetary Fund under Strauss-Kahn, has taken a step towards displacing the dollar as the world reserve currency. So that means you won't be able to just send out pieces of green paper. You're going to have to produce exports that the world wants to buy to earn foreign exchange to buy the things you need. Different from what we've had. U.S. can't be the buyer of last resort anymore because the dollar is well on its way now to becoming unacceptable in world trade. So you got to produce that stuff here. If Detroit goes down, in technical terms, the relative potential population density of North America falls below the current level of population. In other words, without industry, it's like the Morgenthau Plan. Remember the Morgenthau Plan? This was the plan put forward by Wall Street elements in the National Unity Government presided over by Roosevelt during World War II. You remember that, you know, Colonel Stimson, the Republican, other Republicans, Frank Knox, they were in the government. Yeah, so was Morgenthau. He was Wall Street's man in the government. And he said, why don't we take Germany and subject them to complete deindustrialization, complete demontage of industry, and make them into an agricultural paradise. Well, everybody saw that will mean genocide for tens of millions of people. Now, here in the United States, same thing, except now you're talking maybe hundreds of millions who will be unsustainable. That is the path Barkey has traced for you. Back in a minute.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Radio, Tarpley reporting from Washington, D.C. Detroit goes down. Civilization in North America takes a big hit. And the world as you know it, of course, is in the process of collapsing. Now, who dictates these policies, right? Obviously, Geithner. But Geithner is a speaking coup for Summers. Summers, this thug, this gangster president of Harvard University, misogynist, womanator, whatever you like, doesn't believe in the universality of the human personality. No, not him. This coterie of financiers, basically grouped around Rubin of Citibank. You know, Rubin has a big fan club out there. You'd be surprised whether Rubin fan club has branches. Citibank, Volcker was, of course, the guy at the Treasury who made sure that the British pound didn't collapse. Interesting preparation for his current job. Now he's got to try to keep the dollar from collapsing. And Geithner and so forth. But the board of directors met a week ago right now. We're talking to you now on the afternoon of, what, April 3rd? April 3rd it is. 1 week ago, the board of directors of the new fascist corporate state, used to be the United States of America, but now it's the fascist corporate state run by Wall Street, came together at the White House to hear a report from their president. In other words, these are the people who put Obama in the White House. They made him. They can unmake him. These are the institutions, of course, that control the CIA and the intelligence community through a network of lawyers, law firms, bond lawyers, stuff like this. Who did we have? The dean of this group, Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan Chase. I want to give you these names because I want you to know who your enemies are. And when you say the market, if you hear some libertarian telling you or Austrian saying, we should have a free market. Well, if you have a free market, these are the people who will dominate it. It's an oligarchy of about 13 zombies, we might say. But actually, the really powerful ones in it are even smaller oligarchy of 4 or 5 at the most. So here's who we have. Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan Chase, the world's greatest derivatives monsters. His derivatives holdings are in the hundreds of trillions. Nobody knows because it's not reportable. Brooksley Bourne lost out in her effort to get it reported 10 years ago. We've got Ken Lewis from Bank of America, a really aggressive defender of oligarchical banking privilege. He says, yes, we want our bonuses, and we want them increased, and we want them now. Then we've got Vikram Pandit of Citigroup, Pandit the Bandit. He's sitting pretty because his stock price, which was at $1, has now gone up to $2.50. So he's got a wonderful story of growth to tell. John Stumpf of Wells Fargo, Herr Stumpf. John Stumpf of Wells Fargo, this is the thing that has phagocytated Wachovia in the same way that they've taken in all sorts of other companies. Ken Chenault of American Express. John Koskinen of Freddie Mac. That was a government agency now privatized. And privatization is what created the problems over there. Privatization, dear Austrians, your method is what brought you Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. Ronald Logue of State Street, L-O-G-U-E. Robert Kelly of Bank of New York Mellon. Bank of New York Mellon, of course, the back office for the TARP. The $700 billion, he knows where the bodies are buried. He can probably blackmail the rest of these people. He's sort of the treasurer of this committee. Rick Waddell, right? Say, suppose that Dimon is the president of it, and maybe Pandit or the other guy from Bank of America is Lewis, is the vice president, right? The secretary might be, Mac of Morgan Stanley or Blankfein of Goldman Sachs, but... The treasurer job is in the hands of Robert Kelly of Bank of New York Mellon. We've got Rick Waddell of Northern Trust. I believe they're the ones who gave Barkey his sweetheart deal on his mortgage. He got subprime rates on the normal property. James Rohr, R-O-H-R, of PNC Financial Services Group. And now we get the dynamic duo, Lloyd Blankfein of Goldman Sachs. This is another designated winner. He might actually be the vice president of this thing with Dimon as president. But Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase are usually the two chosen winners within any corporate state dynamic on the U.S. financial markets. Lloyd Blankfein of Goldman Sachs, John Mack of Morgan Stanley, Richard Davis of U.S. Bank Corp. And then we've got some people that are there more or less to throw a shuck to the smaller banks. Camden Fine, president of the Independent Community Bankers of America, and Ed Yingling of the American Bankers Association. Now, this was a report by Obama, the wholly owned president of the company, to the chairman of the board of this new fascist corporate state. Remember, it is a state-sponsored compulsory cartel for the purpose of driving down production, driving down wages, and propping up bloated, speculative, cancerous values, above all in the derivatives area, but also in other areas. So that is your policy coming out of Obama on Detroit. That is a real turning point. It ought to open the eyes of people. There is no industrial military complex worth talking about. There's only one complex that has a seat at the table in the Obama regime. It is the people who put them there. Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, Wall Street in general. Geithner has got Wall Street written all over him. I have to stress this because the people, the Soros group, the MoveOn.org, right, funded by Soros, the most rapacious in many ways of all of these finance oligarchs, MoveOn.org has got an ad out where they try to make you think that Obama is fighting Wall Street, right, that Obama is saying that's enough when it comes to Wall Street, right? This is the Olbermann line. This is a fraud, and you got to think about it. The demagogy of being a puppet of bankers and attacking bankers gets us back to Germany and Italy in the 1930s, right? Because that was the line coming from the various protagonists of the regimes there. So that is the auto picture. Now let's shift gears for a second. Let's go to London and look at the G20. This conference will rank with the Lausanne Conference of June, July 1932 as a feckless, useless international conference which refused to face what they should have faced. And there were voices being raised before this conference saying it's time to ban derivatives, get rid of derivatives. Remember Scholes, the creator of the Black-Scholes model, the way in which derivatives are theoretically valued. When they do mark to model, it means the Black-Scholes model or some variation thereof, had said that it's time to burn them up and shred them, basically. Get rid of credit default swaps. We had Senator Warner of Virginia asking Bernanke, shouldn't there be a bright line prohibition of at least certain kinds of credit default swaps? Well, they didn't do it. They punted. The London G20 has joined the Lausanne Conference of 1932 as the international conference on the brink of a new deterioration of the world economic crisis, which punted. Now, of course, we've got Gordon Brown, the British Prime Minister, announcing a new world order. Yes, Gordon Brown announces the new world order. The only problem with that is the United Kingdom is bankrupt. They hold auctions for UK government securities, the so-called gilts, and nobody comes. They are bankrupt, bankrupt, bankrupt. Remember the four I's. Let's see if we can remember the four I's of British imperialism. Impotent, isolated, irrelevant, and one more. We'll think of it. That's Gordon Brown. Now, out of this comes basically three sorts of measures. Certainly, Sarkozy is right that this conference marks the decline of the Anglo-Saxons. The U.S.-British domination of the financial world is collapsing into bankruptcy. It's like being the king of Spain and saying, well, I'm absolute and autocratic, but I'm also bankrupt. That's the problem with the U.S. and the British after this. Brown has announced the end of the Washington Consensus, this complex of Hayek, Friedman monetarist doctrines that has run the world for the last 20 years is over, says even Gordon Brown. Back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley from Washington, D.C. In the first hour, you've heard what Hitler, Tojo, and Stalin wanted to do but could not do. That means destroy the Detroit auto factories. Obama is now doing. The war aims of Hitler, Tojo, Stalin were, or would have been in the case of Stalin, to destroy those factories, right? That would be like bombing the Ruhr or what have you. But they couldn't do it. They never got that far. But now the Wall Street group with their point man, Obama, the Wall Street puppet, he is well on his way towards destroying the factories and busting the United Auto Workers. So beware. Now, Let's look at the critical front of Obama not qualified for the presidency. We're very happy to be joined once again by our friend and distinguished colleague here, Phil Berg of Pennsylvania, distinguished lawyer, former candidate on the Democratic ticket for governor, senator of Pennsylvania, Democratic Party official in Pennsylvania, and, of course, the courageous lawyer who has led the fight, and led the fight indeed, towards the Supreme Court and other legal instances to find out about Obama's citizenship and qualification for the presidency. Welcome to you, Phil.
My pleasure. We finally hooked up. Sorry.
We're so glad you could be here again. You're so busy, you don't have Friday afternoon for us anymore. Please give us an update.
Well, update. We have three cases. First, the best place to look for updates is ObamaCrimes.com, ObamaCrimes.com. For your knowledge and your listeners, I'm being interviewed right now by Christopher Goins from LaSalle University, who's interviewing me. So he's also doing this, but he's here doing a project for school, and I appreciate Chris allowing me to be on the radio while we're doing his interview. We have three cases pending. One is with they're all in federal court. The one is where I was dismissed in the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, where the judge dismissed said I didn't have any standing. When he did that, he said that I didn't have standing and you didn't have standing, Webster, and no one in this country had standing. And in the future, perhaps Congress will decide who should have standing to be able to bring an action against the U.S. Constitution. I think the judge is completely wrong. This is the case we took up to the U.S. Supreme Court on an emergency basis to try to have some injunctions issued. They did not. Then they turned down my emergency request for a writ of certiorari without judgment. But the case is alive and well. It's in the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. Briefs have been filed by both sides, and they've now scheduled tentatively argument for the end of May of this year, May of 2009. So we're encouraged by that because that will be a public hearing, and hopefully one of these days, the national media will be embarrassed enough to start carrying this story, which should be the number one story in this country.
So, Phil, that's the end of May where?
In the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, which sits in Philadelphia. The Third Circuit covers Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.
Okay.
Okay, so that's on the standing issue. The next case we have is we sued Hollister versus Barry Sotoro, a.k.a. Barack Hussein Obama. And we sued Barry Sotoro because we believe that is his legal name from Indonesia, where he was adopted, and we believe he never formally changed his name after that. Well, that case, we'll be putting up a new press release any time now. I've just been on trial the past couple weeks, so we're a little behind. But the judge in that case gave such a horrendous opinion. That judge in that case was so biased from the inception because when we initially filed the lawsuit, we had a local Washington, D.C. attorney, as you need, and myself and Larry Joyce, another attorney from out in Arizona, had filed as co-counsel, and we filed what's called a motion to be admitted pro hoc vici. This is when you're admitted when you're not a member of that particular court. I've been admitted to pro hoc vici courts all across this nation, and in a case I just filed the other day, was filed the next day, they accepted me pro hoc vici. This particular judge decided that he was going to hold it in abeyance, so we appeared in front of him and explained our background, our credentials, and why he should admit us for this particular case. Excuse me. So I think that showed his bias right from the outset. His opinion is outrageous because it's a five-page opinion, and it'll be posted shortly, if not yet, on our site. His opinion, we've been arguing, under the Constitution, as you know and your listeners know, there's three requirements for president. You be 35 years of age. You've lived in this country for 14 years, and there's a question with Obama on that, but we give him that. And the third requirement is you be natural born. Well, we can go into that, but just the judge in the D.C. case, he writes in his opinion nothing about natural born. He talks about Obama being native born. I mean, I don't even understand.
He hasn't set a format reading the Constitution, has he?
No, not at all. And then he filed a rule to show cause against our Washington, D.C. attorney why he should not impose sanctions against him for filing this kind of lawsuit. So we responded to that, and we appealed both. We're now in the District of Columbia Court of Appeals on that case. And we look forward to, filing our briefs there and have an argument in that court.
Let me just buzz, would be Rule 11 sanctions for a frivolous lawsuit. Am I right?
That's correct.
And that can be heavy stuff. So this is very menacing. People should realize this is not a Tea Party, right? This is an angry judge, I guess, in this case.
Right. But what happened was we lucked out on that because the judge failed to hold a hearing on the sanction issue. And by not holding a hearing, you cannot impose monetary sanctions. You can only do so. He ended up giving just a reprimand to our local attorney because the judge failed to. If you want to impose dollar sanctions, which you can, up to a lot of money, you must hold a hearing. So he didn't do that. So the judge, I guess, basically screwed up on that and reprimanded our attorney. But we filed an appeal on that because there should have been no question of sanctions. I mean, we are just trying to enforce the U.S. Constitution. And we feel we had a very legitimate case on the interplay interaction with Hollister, and we'll see how the District of Columbia Court of Appeals handles it, and or we'll track it up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Excuse me. I have a third case pending, which I can't talk about. That's the case under seal. I filed a motion to unseal the case, but they filed a motion against it. So the next date of significance is, I think, April 20th, but... Well, something else was just filed, which I can't talk about. But I feel that that case will open up this whole case, and hopefully one of these judges one of these days will grant us what we need, and that's discovery. If we get discovery in any of these cases, Obama's days as being a legitimate president, which he isn't, are numbered. We have heard that he has spent over $1 million in defending all these lawsuits across this nation. Why would you spend $1 million if you have nothing to hide? I mean, if we think about this, this is the most outrageous situation. We have a incumbent, we have a president who I call him a usurper because he's not properly there, which means that all these things he's signing, all these acts he's signing and appointments he's making are all avoidable, or actually void, but they're avoidable when the courts come around to it. So, and I think we're getting more and more people on our side. Our website's down, right? I mean, down on numbers. We're only getting 1 million hits a day right now. We were up to like 2 million, but we're getting 1 million hits a day. So we ask people to spread the word of our website. Now, interesting enough, coming up is the Tea Parties are spreading across the nation on the issue of the taxation issue. Well, one person promoting, I think it came from the National Group, said one of the signs they should bring to the Tea Party is, Mr. Obama, show us your birth certificate, which is significant because they're trying to attack Obama, saying that constitutionally they can't do what he's doing as far as all this spending. Well, there's nothing more critical issue than our issue, which is the fact that he's not legitimate. He is constitutionally ineligible. He's constitutionally unqualified to be president. And it's really a disgrace that the U.S. Congress didn't do what they were supposed to do on January 8th, because they can only vote for a legitimate candidate, as well as the electors back in December.
Hang on 1 minute, Phil. We'll get a few more points covered, and then we'll let you go.
Okay.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
World Crisis Radio, Webster Tarpley in Washington, D.C., joined on the line by Phil Berg in Philadelphia. And as Phil points out, if you're going to go to an anti-Obama protest, a Tea Party, and so forth, the most effective argument you can make is the question of the usurper, not qualified to be president, illegal, foreign citizen, undocumented alien, if you like. Therefore, these measures are null and void. Much better that than to get into some of the, shall we say, Austrian rhetoric that tends to fly around these tea parties. So wasn't there another one, the interpleader?
Well, no, That's the Hauser case, the interpleader case. The fourth case, which we just haven't put together yet, we're going to be filing a quo warranto case, which several other attorneys have done. Ours will be better when we file it. The best place to be is with us. There's some other attorneys out there doing things. There's a female attorney doing things, which I will have nothing to do with because she's a loose cannon. People can figure out who she is. You can't keep, she's like got a lot of active duty servicemen saying they're going to sue. Well, that's bad because they can't sue in their Article III courts, which like in Pennsylvania would be Common Pleas and Commonwealth and Superior and Supreme Court. They're subject to the military courts, and they're going to get court-martialed, and or they could friendly fire can occur because, you know, you can't do that. So I think she's really jeopardizing those people. And
Phil, if I may, I guess maybe I can say what you can't say because you have to observe the court's decorum, but I'm of course, nothing of a talker here. Right. This is Orly Tates. She's got her picture in the Globe as somehow being a leading light of this movement. She seems to have arrived on the scene rather late in the day and with tactics which always seem to be counterproductive and questionable. So you're left very, very puzzled. But for sure we know the gold standard in this anti-Obama litigation is Phil Berg. And if you want to know what's going on, you've got to go to ObamaCrimes.com. It deserves everybody's financial support and ObamaCrimes.com political support. And indeed, make up crudely lettered signs if you're going to go to the tea parties or whatever else they are. Make your crudely lettered signs based on ObamaCrimes.com, and don't let some misleader tell you that that's not an admissible issue. In some ways, that's the most effective issue when it comes to this.
It really is, because if he's a usurper, he doesn't belong in office, then everything he's doing now is illegal and fraudulent. So that's the issue. That's the broader issue, which can encompass everything that the people at the Tea Parties want to accomplish, and we welcome any of their support. The great sign could be just what they suggested, Mr. Obama. Show us your birth certificate, you know.
Right, it's the clearest, because if he wants to get rid of all this grief, Barkey, just produce your full vault copy birth certificate with time, doctor, witnesses, the detailed one. He knows which one we mean, the one that he's hiding.
Because I'm sure it's from Kenya. But real quick, even if he was born in Hawaii, he would have lost his citizenship when his parents divorced, his mother remarried, and his stepfather took him to Indonesia where he was adopted. We have a school record on our website, ObamaCrimes.com, which shows his name is Barry Sotoro, his nationality being Indonesia, and his religion being Islam. He came back to Hawaii at the age of 10. If he went through immigration after being a natural of Indonesia, he would only be naturalized. We believe he did not go through immigration, and therefore he's an illegal alien, not only not able to be president, but also not able to be a United States senator from Illinois for those 3 years.
Very good. Well, we're delighted you could be with us this time again, Phil, and we want you here every week, naturally, for an update. And again, ObamaCrimes.com, go there and make a contribution. And maybe you come back next week, Phil. Tell us if there's anything in terms of amicus curiae and things like this that can be done.
Sure.
There could be some of these Third Circuit cases and so forth. Maybe you can give us some guidance on that, because people want to support you and they want to intervene.
Thank you. I will be glad
to. That's Phil Berg. Thank you very much, Phil. Notice also, people, if you're going to go to these Tea Party things, the constitutional basis of what Berg is saying is watertight, ironclad. There's no doubt. You want to be president? You've got to be natural born. Born in the United States and not lose your citizenship. That contrasts very favorably to the rather dubious constitutional arguments that you might hear thrown around at some of these meetings. So Phil Berg is the man, the gold standard on the Obama qualifications for the president, and don't let anybody else lead you down the garden path, because as soon as Berg came forward, then suddenly out of the woodwork came many people, I'm sure most of them in goodwill, but some of them rather confused in their methods. All right, what Hitler, Tojo, and Stalin tried to do, i.e. destroy those Detroit auto plants, Obama is doing. Think about a century, more than a century, of labor. I recommend people get this book, The Flivver King. The Flivver King, F-L-I-V-V-E-R. The first is F as in Frank, F-L-I-V-V-E-R. The Flivver King by Upton Sinclair. It's a very short novel, 100 pages, published by an obscure labor publisher in the Midwest. It's the story of Henry Ford and some families living near him around 1890 to 1900, and it goes through the period of the Depression, the creation of the United Auto Workers, sit-down strikes, and so forth. And you got two sides to it. One is the buildup of technology, of science, of industry, of human progress, the stuff of human progress that are concentrated in those plants. And on the other side, the labor struggles. Think of it, the great Detroit sit-down strikes of 1936-37, the Toledo Auto Light strike, the Battle of Deputies Run. What's described in the Upton Sinclair book is a moment where Henry Ford brings out machine guns and sets them up on an overpass. So if you're trying to march from Detroit to Flint, you're going to get machine gunned by Henry Ford. Those labor struggles to build the UAW. The UAW is something that's worth more than you would conclude by looking at this bankrupt Gettelfinger leadership. There's something real there. Gettelfinger, why don't you call for a general strike? How about a nationwide general strike? Start with 3 hours. Don't make it too ambitious. Against Obama. And the issue is reindustrialization. What are your demands, Gettelfinger? Here are your demands. Nationalize Ford, Chrysler, and General Motors. Put them under government protection. They will not shut down. They nationalized the warranty. Now nationalize the rest. Kick out Nardelli and any other hedge fund creatures. Kick out the Wall Street, cost accountants, the fat-headed green eyeshade set. Bring in competent industrial engineers. Freeze all the debts. Above all, take away all of the derivatives from General Motors Acceptance Corporation and the parallel institutions at Chrysler and Ford. Get rid of those derivatives. Get them out of the picture. Freeze them, again, shred them, delete them, destroy them any way you can. Give these companies a comprehensive debt moratorium. Give them a 5-year break. The bondholders, take a bath. But the workers' interests, since they are the majority in terms of numbers, has got to be protected. And above all, you can have a plant going without bondholders, but you got to have workers on the assembly line and in the tool and die department. So that's what you have to do. We'll be back in a minute.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN, great talk radio starts here.
Crisis Radio, your host Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C., calling your kind attention once again to Surviving the Cataclysm, your guide to the worst financial crisis in human history. That's available from www.progressivepress.com. Paper publication is imminent, but get your copy now from progressivepress.com. Call your attention also to find documentary classic masterpiece from Alex Jones. This is an effort which deserves the support of all persons of goodwill. If you're sincerely involved in opposing Obama, this is something you have got to support, buy, duplicate, and otherwise promote. It's called The Obama Deception. I'm in it, but many others are too. And it is the leading edge right now of the anti-Obama effort. So Infowars.com, PrisonPlanet.com, truly meritorious. There will be a sequel coming up. I'm sure Alex will tell his listeners about this over on this same network. Also, Obama the Postmodern Coup, The Making of a Manchurian Candidate, and Barack H. Obama, The Unauthorized Biography, both available from Amazon.com. German and Japanese editions of those are out. Italian edition is imminent. And hopefully more. Now, let's look at this London G20 now. This is a monstrosity. Brown, sitting on top of the bankrupt Bank of England, says the New World Order is here. Strauss-Kahn, sitting on top of the bankrupt International Monetary Fund, says the IMF is back. And, of course, their idea is to make the special drawing rights, SDR, special drawing rights, into the world currency. A lot of people have been distracted by any number of things, I don't know, Ameros here and there. The likely hypothesis is what you see, that the special drawing rights of the IMF are going to be the world currency. We know that they're in the process of issuing more, a global quantitative easing reported in the London Daily Telegraph some 2 weeks ago. Alistair Darling in the U.S. Treasury, working under the orders of George Soros and U.S. Treasury Advisor Ted Truman, are gearing up special drawing rights. So that means we can have not only hyperinflation in the dollar, the euro, the yen, and the rest of them, we can also have hyperinflation of special drawing rights. So we've got a new dimension of pyramided hyperinflation going on. So as a result of this conference, the decision is, at least as a pledge, now I hope everybody will welch on this, I urge them to do it. Now that you're out of Barkey's clutches, go home and don't do this, but they're pledged to put in $1.1 trillion to the International Monetary Fund. And this has to be contributed by the taxpayers of countries, by you. Guess what? Geithner, who can't balance his TurboTax, right? Geithner, that little weasel from Wall Street, wants to give $100 billion, with a B, U.S. taxpayer dollars to the International Monetary Fund. So it's a total of $1,100 billion, or $1.1 trillion, for the IMF. Just like that, a new huge bailout. Again, I hope it won't happen. It may never happen. Let's hope it doesn't happen. But right now, this is where we're headed, so fight it. Remember, in Barkey's budget, $20 billion for food stamps. 1 in 10 Americans lives on food stamps. 1 in 8 people in Michigan. 3 million people in Texas. Do the arithmetic. And the big improvement under Barkey is that instead of getting $115 a month if you're an individual on food stamps, you're going to get $125 to $130. Isn't that great? When $100 billion is going to the International Monetary Fund of Dominique Strauss-Kahn, the French financier? Are we dreaming? Are we in delirium? So that's the IMF. Now, what's the point of this? We're told they're going to help needy countries in the third world. Baloney. What they're going to do is pay debt service on the massive debts of African, South Asian, Latin American countries. This is a way to keep the underdeveloped countries, the sweatshop, runaway shop countries of the globalized system within the system. Because at this point, you could imagine a lot of people are saying, why don't we impose exchange controls, capital controls, protective tariff, and try a national road to economic survival? That is the inherent dynamic you see in the last depression, and it's not all bad, right? Don't tell me that Hawley Smoot caused the great economic depression. That is baloney. That's another one of your right-wing free trade myths. So the third world countries have got to be kept in the system. Strauss-Kahn boasts that he now has the firepower. Reminds me of Paulson wanting to have the bazooka. So Strauss-Kahn has got the firepower, the Paulsonian bazooka, so he can go to these countries and say, you're staying inside the system. Now, the IMF, of course, was bankrupt because they had lent all their money to Ukraine, Belarus, Turkey, Iceland, Pakistan, a series of other Eastern Europeans. And a lot of this will go to Eastern Europeans, mark my words, at least if the Europeans have anything to say about it. And because of the voting system, they will have something to say. Mexico has announced that it will go groveling to the International Monetary Fund. It is thought that Great Britain may be close to go groveling to the International Monetary Fund. Now, Strauss-Kahn says, we're not going to be as mean and nasty on conditionalities as we used to be. Remember, the Washington Consensus meant that if you wanted money from the IMF, you had to have deregulation, privatization, union busting. You had to basically gut your child labor laws, any kind of regulations that would protect labor or consumers or tenants or anybody like this was considered absolutely inadmissible. In other words, the Austrian school doctrine that the government cannot interfere in economic life which had run wild under the IMF conditionalities, the infamous letter of intent. If you wanted an IMF loan, you had to submit to their conditionalities and say so in a letter of intent. That's the Washington consensus. And, of course, the conditionalities were never voted on by anybody, but they were a distillation of Friedman, von Hayek, von Mises, the Chicago and Austrian orthodoxy, which has destroyed the world. So they now say, Brown says that the Washington consensus is finished. Strauss-Kahn says that the conditionalities are going to be relaxed. Well, let's wait and see on that one, because union busting is something that they love. Maybe they're going to try to do it under left cover like they're doing it here in the U.S. So that is one side of it. The loans, however, to the Third World will be made with special drawing rights. That's a big, big step towards removing the dollar as the world reserve currency and replacing it not with something better, but with something worse, actually, because the goal of this is to reach a situation where the United States will have to go groveling to the International Monetary Fund and submit to conditionalities and write a letter of intent in which sovereignty will be abrogated. And what will the demands be? Union busting, wage gouging, deregulation, privatization, the whole freedom catalog of the Austrian school will be dictated by the International Monetary Fund. And if you believe in that Austrian Chicago stuff, you will be unable to resist as your pension is taken away and you will be left with nothing but your eyes to cry with, no medical care, no pension, no food stamps, no Head Start, no nothing, but consoled by the doctrines of the Austrian school, this time imposed by the IMF. Now, most people in the world have the intelligence to fight that. Let's see if people here in this country have the intelligence to fight what is going to be imposed. Now, the second one is no protectionism. Again, a lot of people would be looking back to Mahathir Mohamad in 1998 when he said, if we're going to get out of this here in Malaysia, we better have exchange controls and capital controls. And that's what a lot of third world countries should do. That's what the Russians should have done as early as a year ago. They'd have twice as much foreign exchange right now if they'd kept some of that money inside Russia instead of letting it go as a will-o'-the-wisp, as hot money out the door. The other one now is financial regulation. The pressure from Sarkozy and Merkel was to attack hedge funds and to some extent derivatives. This has largely been blunted. We'll be back in a minute.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Crisis Radio. Remember to get Surviving the Cataclysm, Your Guide to the Worst Financial Crisis in Human History from www.progressivepress.com. Other books by me, Obama the Postmodern Coup and Barack H. Obama, the Unauthorized Biography, available at amazon.com. A couple of words more on this London G20. Forget about Barkey meeting the Queen. Notice Barkey also. Barkey met Camilla Parker Bowles, who sure enough had a tumbler of wine in her hand. Boozing Camilla was there. They all were subjected to Barkey's magic, his hypnotic appeal, great exercise in mass hypnosis by Barkey. Teleprompter everywhere at this one. So $1.1 trillion for the IMF. The lending will be in SDRs, not dollars. Big step down for the U.S. dollar, and not good. I mean, nothing good in it. Not that we're here to defend the dollar as an instrument of world financial dictatorship. But what you've got here is a world currency dictatorship now located in the International Monetary Fund, which is one step above the Federal Reserve. It's even further out of reach for the average person. Financial regulation, This is more or less self-consulting rhetoric, edifying rhetoric, but they say that they want to have a market for credit default swaps somewhere in the world by the end of the year. Well, I'll believe that when I see it. There's also a question of tax havens. Sarkozy had to get left cover. Sarkozy is in big trouble. Brown is in big trouble. Merkel, so-so. But Sarkozy needed some left cover. Notice, everybody is in a race to get left cover, not to posture with free market nonsense, but to get left cover. I'm a friend of the masses. I'm for labor. I'm for the people. I'm for the workers. So Sarkozy said, I want to know a list of all the tax havens and condemn them and shame them. And the Chinese said, ooh, wait a minute, that might get too close to us. So Sarkozy striving for left cover. Mexico about to grovel to the IMF. Mexican political forces listening to this, don't go. Don't do it. Don't submit to the IMF. And don't let this go through here. No support for the $100 billion demanded by little weasel Geithner for the IMF so they can keep the poor third world locked into this system by attempting to get them to maintain debt service payments to people like Soros, right, the Club of Paris and the Club of London. Also, when they say they're going to re-regulate anything, look what they just did. The Federal Accounting Standards Board here this week has said we're not going to have mark-to-market anymore. the great market has been dethroned once again. No more mark-to-market, but now mark to whatever you want, mark to your wildest dreams. Maybe mark to model, but you can obviously cook the model. The Black-Scholes model is the basis of all of these, as we've said, but now they can do, you know, Son of Black-Scholes, Black-Scholes 3, Black-Scholes, the prequel, the sequel, and all the rest of it. The goal of this is, of course, derivatives. They have all these derivatives on the books that are worthless. Not only worthless, they have negative value, and that is what is dragging down the U.S. bank. So this past week, the U.S. government says you can now market to anything you want, and this was the key to propping the stock market up for the last couple of days after the ominous signs of another dive were there. Now, notice, however, on the day that the mark-to-market was abolished and the mark-to-Alice in Wonderland was begun, U.S. Treasury bonds took quite a beating. They were not so popular as they were. So we've now had all kinds of ominous signs that the dollar is beginning the slide, right? Hyperinflation may be beginning. The day that Bernanke pumped in $1 trillion, the dollar took a beating. Treasury bonds took the biggest beating in about a quarter of a century. Another big dive for the T-bonds this past week. And now the dollar being replaced by the special drawing rights in key areas of international lending. That's the stuff the dollar lives on. So if you take away international lending and the international lending institutions, the dollar is in big trouble. So that is, I think, a wrap-up on the this London G20. A budget resolution has passed last night in the U.S. Congress. This is not Barkey's budget anymore, but it's Barkey's budget somehow touched up to meet the needs of Specter, Collins, Snow, and so forth to get some support. We got to see what's in it. Naturally, these are big things, but it'll be Barkey light in some version, most likely. Then we've also got the question that's left over, the theoretical question. On Detroit, what is the difference between productive and non-productive? You can tell from the way people talk about the Detroit auto situation. They don't know that this distinction exists. Now, the starting point is any kind of economics has got to recognize an apparent dualism of price and value. They don't seem to go together. How can it be that the price of General Motors goes down to practically nothing when those are real plants with real assembly lines, real machine tools, and all the rest? What it shows is that the market is inherently unreliable, that the market is wrong, tragically, destructively wrong most of the time. And, of course, the whole idea of a financial bubble, and the financial bubbles have gone on for years. Every time you have a mania, a bubble, a hysteria, tulip bubble, South Sea bubble, Mississippi bubble, Greenspan bubble, housing bubble, dot-com bubble, That means the market is wrong. The market is telling you something that is not true. The market is telling you that something has a price which is not in line with the true value. Now, what is value? Most of these characters, Austrians, Chicagoites, and Keynesians also, do not recognize that there's something separate from price which is value. Now, value, of course, is the possible ramifications of an array of commodities for human society. In other words, you need things to eat, to wear, to live in, to drive, to use as tools, the tools of your trade. Capital goods, in particular, are a very big department of this. So value means what is the contribution of a given commodity to that entire process. This is not the same as the price. So there's a dualism, but it's only an apparent dualism, because ultimately the price and value, in other words, the amount that you can get for it on Wall Street or the Rialto or Threadneedle Street, and the actual possible contribution of these commodities or whatever they are towards human society, these have got to coexist in the universe. In other words, whatever's going on in the financial realm, there are no human individuals except through the creation of a surplus in industrial and agricultural production. And production is the word you never hear from these clowns, except in the moments when they want to get rid of it, right, as Barkey has done. So price and value dualism, but it's not an absolute dualism. Oh, my God, no. It's only a relative. It's an apparent dualism, which is periodically brought back into realignment, and that is what's going on right now. The moment of the panic crash is the moment where, for example, we were told that Citibank was worth 90 or 100, and then it became worth 1. Bear Stearns was worth 50 or 60, then it became worth 0 and negative. We've got 1.5 quadrillion of derivatives, and in reality, this has extreme negative value. It's going to destroy civilization if you try to maintain it. So the market is wrong, 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 wrong. The market is unreliable. If you tie your wagon to the market, you will be dragged into the abyss. Because right now what's going on is we're in a worldwide derivatives panic. We're walking around on the negative curvature of the inside of a collapsing bubble. And right now a realignment, in other words, the price of things is being brought down to the level of their value. That's why when they say, oh, $50 trillion of value were wiped out of wealth, no, that was never wealth. Forget it. That was just paper. That was price, not value, not wealth. So what is production? Production is progressive changes in the order of nature, progressive alterations in the planet around us and in the biosphere. Production creates something new. It is an absolute novum. It is something that never was before. It comes, of course, from scientific discovery, realized as technology, then made into capital goods for industry. So, production, non-production. Detroit is on the productive side, even with the distortions that it has. Wall Street is the opposite. Therefore, the result is turn Bernanke on his head. Turn the Fed on their head, stop bailouts for Wall Street, start using that money for infrastructure, industry, agriculture, you get a recovery. But if you attempt to bail out the derivatives bubble, down into the abyss you go. And that's the path taken by Geithner and the London G20. See you next week.